Good evening. This is Janet Sanders, Assistant Dean of Women at KU, and I'd like to welcome you to A Feminist Perspective. This weekly radio broadcast is sponsored by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center, a program and information service of the Dean of Women's Office, 220 Strong Hall. A Feminist Perspective provides a forum for women themselves to speak publicly on issues of concern to them and helps inform other women and men of the movement which is remaking the shape and substance of women's and men's lives. The Women's Resource and Career Planning Center contains large amounts of information, newspaper clippings, government documents, magazine articles, research studies, and books pertaining to the many aspects of the women's movement. We would like to invite you to come in and browse around or take advantage of the materials which can be borrowed. That's in 220 Strong Hall at the University of Kansas. Tonight's program is part of a series on choice and sexuality. Our tentative topic is choice and contraception, and our guest tonight is Dr. Dale Clinton. Dr. Clinton is a graduate of KU and of the University of Kansas Medical School. He is in private practice in Lawrence and Kansas City, and he specializes in reproductive medicine. Dr. Clinton, how would you define reproductive medicine? That's a new specialty for me.
I was afraid you'd ask that, and I'm not sure I know how to define it either. But I deal largely in such things as family planning, office gynecology. I do male sterilizations. I don't do female sterilizations. Those are referred. But in the general area of illnesses related to reproduction and sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Clinton, I consider to be quite an expert in the area I wanted to consider tonight, and originally I had named it contraception, which in some ways I believe is technically incorrect as to what I want to discuss. I guess what I'm talking about is family limitation, determining how many children you want, when you want them. Let's start out in the area of contraception and discuss some of the choices that are available to women and to men who are planning on being sexually active and don't want children. I guess one place to start out, I've read some figures that indicate if a couple is having an active and regular sexual relationship, within the first year of that relationship, they have a 50% chance of conceiving, and if it goes on for 2 years, an 80% chance that there will be a pregnancy.
Yes, I've heard those figures, and I think there's another figure that one can depend upon fairly accurately, I think, and that is the people who are having regular active sexual contacts, that the woman, statistically speaking, will be pregnant within 5 months. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is another way, I think, of saying somewhat the same thing here.
So this, it seems like biologically a woman's choices are limited. If she is sexually active, is going to have a pregnancy
unless she does something effective about it, or unless they do something about it, one or the other, or both.
Uh-huh. All right, so let's assume that a person has made the initial choice that they do not want children at this present time. Mm-hmm. Now then, let's consider the wide spectrum of options available to people. Let's start with the non-prescription methods. What do you consider to be the most effective, other than abstinence,
yes,
the most effective non-prescription
method? Well, even abstinence is not very effective because there are, there are ways to be abstinent and get pregnant too, almost. Well, of the non-prescription items, and you're saying other than the birth control pill and the IUD, diaphragm is also a prescription item,
yes,
although actually it's just for the fitting. Okay, well then let's start with the diaphragm and work down from there. Statistically, you can locate many different sets of figures, but the diaphragm with jelly or the foam, mm-hmm, without a diaphragm and the rubber all fall in the 70% effective range, for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, with any of these four methods, you get about a 30% failure rate, and this is, for most people, unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
If you combine, say, foam and rubber, then you theoretically cut the failure rate down to about 10%, which is also pretty high.
Yes.
And it depends upon how you look at this 10%. You mean one out of every 10 times you get pregnant? You see, then that's unacceptable. But anyhow, these are the choices that are available in the non-prescription area. And I think it's interesting. It's interesting to me, and for this reason, I don't fit diaphragms, in fact, and that is that foam properly used is statistically just as effective as diaphragm and jelly.
Hmm.
And many people don't know this. Many mm-hmm. people will contest this statement, too, mm-hmm. however. But the diaphragm, actually the only purpose of the diaphragm is to keep the jelly in place, literally. And the foam stays in place about that well if it's used properly. So for women who insist upon using this sort of method, I tell them that they're just as well off to use the foam.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want double the protection, then they can use it with the rubber also.
I think that you brought up an interesting point. If it's used properly, I've read several things which indicate that these non-prescription methods have such a high rate of failure because people do not use them
mm-hmm.
properly.
Mm-hmm.
Women insert the foam too early, or else
or
they
late.
Douche immediately
yeah.
after
mm-hmm.
using it.
Mm-hmm.
A man does not know how to properly use a condom. What kind of suggestions can you give people for increasing the effectiveness of these kind of methods?
Use them properly. Well, I don't know. You mean you want to go into specifics about
well,
this?
Well, I'm just wondering. I have a sample kit of contraceptives,
mm-hmm.
which I use in my counseling, and I've noticed that the packages of condoms have no instructions.
No instructions, right. Okay, now the foam does, and this is something I started to say. If one will read the instructions on the foam package and follow the instructions, then that's about the best you can do. It tells you when to use it and how to use it. True, prophylactics, to my knowledge, I don't know of any that have instructions, but there probably are some. But the important thing is not that they break very often. They do sometimes, but this isn't the big factor. The big factor is that they come off
mm-hmm.
and that they leak.
Mm-hmm.
And so, around the edges, that is, and so, of course, it's a mistake to use a rubber, say, and then fall asleep, you see. I mean, that's a guarantee. So one has to be rather careful about the method.
Mm-hmm.
The careful about what ones do. You don't have absolute freedom. In other words, there are certain routines you have to follow if it's going to work.
All right. What you've left out one of the non-prescription methods.
And that's I left out two.
Oh, all right. I was thinking of rhythm, and I thought
rhythm
was conspicuously
absent. In my opinion, and as we're getting more experience with menstrual extractions. The rhythm system, as I have stated before, I consider to be a mythological method of birth control because it simply does not work.
Mm-hmm.
And women, although they usually ovulate somewhere around mid-cycle, the ones that get caught can testify to the fact that that is not when they ovulated. You know, the ones that get pregnant and know that the only time they had intercourse was at the end of their period or the middle of their period, and they got pregnant anyhow, you see.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a reliable method. It has a very high failure rate, and so I call it exactly that. It's mythological, not just in terms of religious myths, but I think it's one of the medical myths that we have perpetuated over the years, and that is that women ovulate at a certain time. That's not true.
I've been reading some research that people have been trying to do to ensure the rhythm method. For example,
mm-hmm.
one of the things was kind of a litmus test,
mm-hmm.
and you put a piece of treated tape in the woman's mouth every morning for a month, and when she ovulates, the saliva, the chemical composition changes, and you can tell, aha, this is the fertile time. Some of these research
things go back five years. To great sex. Yeah, but go ahead.
and still, we don't seem to have any reliable predictor
no.
on the market.
No.
And I was wondering if there was such a thing as spontaneous ovulation. Sometimes in the literature you read that intercourse itself might bring on.
Well, we know
ovulation.
It does in other animals, and I presume it occasionally occurs in the human, but in other words, that sexual excitement
mm-hmm.
Initiates ovulation. I don't think this is documented as a thing that occurs very often in the human female, however.
But nevertheless, ovulation can occur any time during the cycle.
Yes,
it does. And so the rhythm method.
The usual grouping is around the center, but you can't depend upon it.
All right. What was the other non-prescription?
Withdrawal. Statistically, yes. About 25% effective.
Mm-hmm. Better than nothing, but not too much.
Better than nothing, but not much more. Not much better than nothing.
Now, sometimes when I am visiting the residence halls and discussing contraception, I come across some myths, and I wondered if you would care to comment on them. Mm-hmm. And one of them is about the famous Coca-Cola douche. Mm-hmm. And it was explained to me very seriously that the way this works is that the sugar in the Coca-Cola explodes the head of the sperm and kills it. And that this is widely practiced among teenagers as a form of birth control.
I hadn't heard that theory. I mean, Coca-Cola and 7-Up and anything else under pressure, of course, it can be used expertly as a douche. I mean, you get a lot of liquid there under considerable pressure, you know. Mm-hmm. And you can do a douche, but the point is that the douche is not an effective method of contraception, and even if it does explode the head of the sperm, the one you're worried about is long gone, you see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not available for explosion. He's already inside the cervix.
Yes.
So okay. I would say that is definitely a myth.
Well,
that's not effective.
I think that we've effectively exploded that myth in particular. Let's move on then to the prescription methods. Now, I noticed that you counted the diaphragm as non-prescription after the first prescription of it.
Well,
and after that, then the woman can continue, for a year, perhaps longer?
With the diaphragm?
Before she needs to be refitted?
Rubber deteriorates, and probably the safe time is about a year, and then it should be replaced. And it really should be refitted then, too, because things change.
Mm-hmm.
The woman's, the woman's weight, if she gains weight, her measurements are likely to change, too. See?
Mm-hmm.
So she should be remeasured, but if she's going to use it. But I don't like the diaphragm at all. I think it's really kind of an archaic sort of method to use.
All right, let's move on to the IUD.
Okay, the IUD then, and this is the next best method.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps
the pill being the best.
Why don't you explain a little bit about what the IUD is and how it works?
All right, the IUD is, for the most part, most IUDs are plastic devices which are inserted into the uterus, and they provide contraception by a method or methods not too clearly understood, but apparently some modification of a foreign body reaction, that is the lining of the uterus, the endometrium, does react to this as though it were a foreign body and produces certain cells which render the endometrium incapable of implantation of the fertilized egg.
Conception
occur. Apparently does occur. Well, now this is debated, mm-hmm. because the IUD does have some other effects which have been demonstrated, at least in monkeys, and that is that it speeds up the rate of ovum transport. Once the egg leaves the ovary, the foreign body in the uterus apparently causes contractions that mm-hmm. speed up the transport of the egg so that it arrives in a state which is unfertilizable. And so certainly in monkeys, unfertilized eggs have been recovered with some regularity. Whether this occurs in the human, we don't
mm-hmm.
really know.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently the general consensus of opinion is that its main function is that it does something to the endometrium which makes implantation impossible.
All right, and a doctor needs to insert the IUD, is this correct?
Yes, this is considered a surgical procedure, and indeed it is, in that it doesn't involve a cutting procedure, but it does involve the invasion of a body cavity in a sense that's a little bit different than brushing your teeth, I would say, for
mm-hmm.
instance, you know. And in fact, usually it involves dilatation of the cervix. There are forms that can be put on without dilatation. The most popular brands now will go in without dilatation, but it's a little bit risky because it's a hard push and you might just put it right on through the uterine wall, you see.
Mm.
So I think most physicians prefer to dilate first, and then they know exactly where they're putting it. And in fact, placement is important for effectiveness, too.
All right. Well, how effective is the IUD?
The manufacturers say 2% failure rate. In effect, they say 2 pregnancies per 100 woman years. And this is not exactly translatable into 2% mm-hmm. failure rate, but this is the order.
If we have 100 women, each of them using the IUD for an entire
over a year's time, the manufacturer says we'll see 2 pregnancies. I think they're a lot higher than that. I don't know how high, because I really haven't. I've put in about 1,000, I would say, give or take 50. Mm-hmm. And this is not a big enough series to know, you know. It really isn't. And so for the people that, or the studies where they put in 10 or 12,000 of these things, they report that they think that the rate is about 2% also. But in everyday practice, I see so many women with IUDs who are pregnant mm-hmm. that I question the figures. I'm seeing a skewed sample here, you see.
I've had the question several times, what is the effect on the development of the fetus if a woman has an IUD and becomes pregnant?
Nothing. If the woman becomes pregnant, the IUD is external to the membranes which enclose the fetus, and I don't believe there's been any case on record where the IUD caused any adverse effect. Mm-hmm. Now, it does have an effect upon spontaneous abortions, however, and we used to think that if you took the IUD out, the chances of her aborting were increased, but now it appears that it's the other way around. If you leave it in, her chances of spontaneous abortion mm-hmm. are apparently increased a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not a great deal, mm-hmm. however. Oh. But as far as deforming the fetus, no.
There's no effect. All right. What about the rejection syndrome? I've heard several women talk about that.
This apparently is improving. That is, whereas the rejection rate with some of the older models was as high as 15%, with some of the newer devices, it's lower than that, I think. But I have seen every model on the market pushed out, mm-hmm. rejected.
Which particular shapes do you use?
Well, at the moment I use the Lippe's loop, and I use the Julius Schmidt safety coil, and I use the Dalcon shield. Those are the three that I keep in stock now. The shield, I think, is probably the least often rejected, that is, expelled mm-hmm. spontaneously.
All right.
I'm not impressed with the pregnancy rate being any lower than the others, however, other than that.
Some of the research materials I've been reading is talking about the copper T, IUD which is covered with a thin coating of mm-hmm. copper, and it's assumed that the copper itself has a contraceptive property.
That's right. Just the other day I took out one from a woman who was pregnant. and so I'm that shattered my hopes in the copper T.
Yes. I think that it would be. That's apparently truly
empirical evidence. It's a comfortable device to wear, apparently. The women, apparently it inserts easily, but certainly women do get pregnant with it. Which I can document.
All right. You were saying that the number one contraceptive, as far as effectiveness, is the oral contraceptive, the pill.
Right.
Just briefly, and in simple terms, if possible, how does the pill work?
Well,
what does it do to a woman's body?
Again, the pill does several things, and we think that it works primarily by inhibition of ovulation, and we also know that it creates some recognizable changes in the endometrium, which means that if the woman does ovulate, and occasionally apparently some women do, that it arrives in the uterus and meets an environment which is not suitable for implantation. Mm-hmm. So it works by two methods. One, it inhibits ovulation. Two, it creates an endometrium which is not suitable for implantation.
All right. And it does this because it is primarily hormones, active
because
hormones.
Right. That's right. And apparently the endometrium has to be prepared in a rather delicate way to receive that egg. And again, the hormones have to be just right for the egg to be released to mm-hmm. begin with.
And so what would you assume the effectiveness rate to be?
Well, the effectiveness rate is stated to be so close to 100% that it's difficult to calculate.
Uh-huh.
There are a few women who do get pregnant, but they're extremely rare.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that many of those pregnancies could be attributed to forgetting a pill?
Yes. I'm talking about genuine failure. Oh. I'm talking about genuine pill failure. Oh, yes, there are. Oh, yeah, a lot of women get pregnant by taking the pill improperly, but that's hard to do, too. Now, for instance, while we talk about myths, and let's lay another one, and that is that if you miss a pill or two, you're going to get pregnant. It is not that critical. And I don't want to get people to think that they can just be real sloppy with the pill, but actually you would have to miss at least enough pills to start a period before you would ovulate. In other words, the woman would get a clear signal that she had forgotten her pills long before she ovulated.
All right. I understand that some of the older pills had higher levels of estrogen, the hormone estrogen,
yes,
than the newer pills. And would you say that there is a greater risk with the lower dosage pills of if you forget a pill for a day or two?
Yes. Yes, I would say that there are. I think, and again, I haven't had this much experience with some of the very latest. And there are, Park Davis, for instance, has two new products called Loestrin, which is simply a variation on their Norlestrin, lower dose. And I don't know what the pregnancy rate is, but I do caution these people to be very careful about taking their pills and not forgetting any and making them up if they do. We know that the old sequentials produced some pregnancies.
All right. I think that a lot of the push for developing the low estrogen pill was on the basis of side effects, both the minor side effects and also people who assumed that major medical disabilities such as blood clots and cancer could result. What's your impression about these side effects?
Well, my impression is that by far the great majority of women can take one of the birth control pills. If the first one or two are not satisfactory, if she'll just stick around a little bit until she gets a formula that is satisfactory for her, that she can take them and be comfortable and effective, and they'll be effective. But the usual, the woman who comes in and says, I have tried everything and I can't take any of the pills, has not tried everything, and probably she can take the pills.
All right. What about the new mini pill that won't have any estrogen in it at all? I have a research report from 1971, and they said within a matter of weeks we will have this this new pill. And
okay.
Have you heard about
that? The mini pill. I don't know whether it's safer or not, because to me there isn't any obvious danger to the other pills either. But the mini pill has two disadvantages. One, it has a known and documented pregnancy rate, pretty close to that of the IUD. It also causes unpredictable bleeding episodes, which most women do not like. Now, this is also true for the injectable contraceptive, which is available and which is approved and which is good for about 3 months, and it works about as well as a pill, apparently, but the bleeding episodes are unpredictable. And most women don't like that, apparently.
Dr. Clinton, there is so much that we could discuss about the pill. I think what I would like to do is recommend that women in the listening audience would consult with their physicians, or perhaps they could call you, or they could call the information center and be referred to a counselor if they have questions about the pill. I think wouldn't you agree that it is very important for a woman to understand what kind of medication she's taking?
Yes, and I think I think the biggest problem with this pill business is that there is about as much misinformation available as there is information. And I'm afraid that this is true of the government publications, including the little warning insert that goes inside the package now, which most women have gotten hold of one time or another, and it is nothing but frightening. It tells the woman nothing useful, but it is frightening. And in fact, some of the statements made in that little warning gadget are on very, very tenuous ground, and the thrombophlebitis bit is far from settled, and most authorities don't think
it's
thrombophlebitis has anything to do with birth control pills at all. So this is a misleading, frightening thing, and I think it is a bad thing. And again, as I say, the problem is that the woman had better have up-to-date information and information from a person who knows and who is not speculating.
All right. We just have a brief amount of time left, and I would like to go on to one further type of choice that women have that they might not be aware that they have, either as a form of family limitation or a last resort in case of contraceptive failure, and that's the new procedure of menstrual extraction. Mm-hmm. Would you describe when a woman is a candidate for menstrual extraction and what is involved in it?
Well, the term menstrual extraction is a difficult thing to define, but generally speaking, when a woman has missed her period and has reason to think that she could be pregnant, that is, she's had intercourse since her last period and is not taking birth control pills, and if she is within 2 weeks of the overdue period, then she is, generally speaking, a candidate for menstrual extraction, which simply means a vacuum curettage of the uterus. It simply means emptying the uterus of whatever is in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this a surgical procedure?
This, I would definitely consider a surgical procedure.
But minor surgery?
Minor surgery, office surgery, yes.
No incision?
No incision.
How does a menstrual extraction take place?
How is it done?
Uh-huh. Could you describe it?
Well, the woman actually, this involves dilatation, slight dilatation of the cervix. Sometimes it can be done without dilatation, but one should expect to be dilated a little bit. A plastic device is put into the uterus, and the endometrium is vacuumed out under under suction.
And this. How long would that take? It's very brief, I understand.
Well, the procedure itself, that is the actual curettage, takes perhaps 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But preparation and instruction and that sort of thing is a 20-30 minute procedure altogether.
Mm-hmm. But still very brief. And how about being effective?
Very effective. Properly done, very effective. Mm-hmm. By properly done, I mean using adequate instruments and using dilatation ahead of time. Primarily because the physician has much better feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
He knows whether or not the job is complete.
You mentioned that when a woman's period is late, she's a candidate for this. How late? What's the ideal time, and what's the maximum time limit beyond which this procedure
is
impossible?
Well, my criteria would include the fact that if the woman is as much as 5 days late, she should immediately contact her physician. Mm-hmm. So that some attempt can be made to start her period without doing an extraction, and if that fails, then she is a candidate.
All right.
So I would say she should begin to worry at day five.
Day five, and then what is the last possible time that it could be done?
Well, this is difficult to say, and I determine by the examination.
Mm-hmm. But let's say that
The menstrual extraction,
12 to 14 days.
It depends upon whether you call it an extraction, but the technique is really quite feasible, technically feasible for at least 6 weeks for the menstrual extraction technique. Beyond that time, other things have to be done, really.
All right. If you have further questions about menstrual extraction, you can call Dr. Clinton or please call the University Information Center. I'd like to thank you very much, Dr. Clinton, for being with us this evening.
It has been a pleasure.
And invite all of you to tune in next week to KANU and A Feminist Perspective.